This is a joint interim task force on Oregon retirement savings. And we're going to do introductions in just a minute, but just by way of preamble or introduction, I want to thank everybody who's participating on this panel. And I know there's a lot of people here who are watching who hope to participate in the public part of this conversation, and I want to thank all of you for your interest in this important subject. It obviously cuts a broad swath across the state of Oregon, as it does nationally. I think it's a timely issue. One might argue that we're even a little late to a game that is already being well played and understood at the national level. I think many of you had volunteered to be part of this task force because you were aware that this issue is certainly one that's important for the state of Oregon. We know that less than half of workers in the private sector in this state have access to a retirement planning tool through their place of employment. And when you consider that against the reality that the elder adult population in our state is projected to double in the next 20 years, what we're facing is nothing less than a economic crisis. And as many people have said, this is a crisis that could threaten to plunge seniors into poverty. It could disrupt entire families. It could have an impact on our economy in a global sense. And so it's an issue that we think is very important to undertake. I want to start off just with the acknowledgement that there are many people who are uncomfortable with the idea of any state entity having a conversation about retirement planning. There are still many people who believe this is a personal decision and a matter of personal responsibility, and I just want to acknowledge that up front. But I also want to say what has been acknowledged as a personal responsibility is rapidly becoming a public crisis, an economic crisis, because as people retire without sufficient retirement savings, that could potentially put a significant load on very costly social service programs in the future. And that's why we think it is an appropriate conversation to have in government. We think as people who lead policy decisions in this state, it's very important that we start understanding what the scope of the issue is here in the state, what the potential implications are for our state and the services that are provided by state government. And frankly, we are a state that has long cared about its older populations and what it means for them to have retirement security in their golden years. And therefore, we feel that we have an obligation to take a good hard look at this, and the legislature has directed us so to do. And in a few minutes, Jan will tell us exactly what they have directed us to do. I have also had a number of conversations with Dick. You may have noticed he has the vice chair placard attached. He's been extremely helpful to me and to my staff in terms of helping to orchestrate a structure for this process. And so I hope you don't mind if I refer to him as vice chair. He's been really helpful to me, given that I have a whole host of responsibilities, and he's a very knowledgeable guy and fun to work with. And so in that context, I've asked him if he would kindly serve as the vice chair and help keep the effort moving forward. Today, our meeting probably will not take the full 2 hours that we are allotted to take. I see this as very much an organizational meeting, an introductory meeting. We're going to have an opportunity to talk about what we see as a potential strategy for getting through the work that we need to get through. We're going to talk briefly about some of the historical efforts that have been undertaken on this subject previously. Where Jan is going to brief us, as I said, on the legislation and what the sideboards were and the requirements of that legislation were. We're going to hopefully have clarity by the time we leave here today in terms of what our goals are and one potential strategy for future meetings in terms of meeting those goals. So with that preamble, what I'd like to do is just take a couple of minutes, and this is an opportunity for us to get to know each other a little bit. It's kind of awkward in front of all of you. Consider it an interesting sociology experiment. But what I really want to know, and maybe Ellen, I'll start with you, is if you could just give us sort of a brief summary of who you are and what you do and why this is important to you and what you hope we'll accomplish as a group. Maybe that would be a good, fun way to start it off.
Sure.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
So I'm Elena Fracchia, and I am here from the United Way of Lane County. And I'm the staff lead on the Financial Stability Partnership down there. And we focus on helping individuals and families get to the end of the month with money left over. And so our work largely focuses on how are we helping those folks that are on the margins of financial stability get to that point that they're really independently and confidently living on their own. That naturally feeds into the idea of how can they do that long-term, sustainably, beyond their work life into retirement, and thinking about what does that life look like? What are they striving towards? How do they want to live? And will they have the resources that they need to do so after working? So my hope with this task force is to really understand the state of retirement in Oregon and understand what are the options and possibilities for families and how can we help them get to a point that they're retiring comfortably.
Thank you, Elena. Mm-hmm. I appreciate it. Jim?
My name is Jim Hauser, and my wife and I own Hawthorne Auto Clinic in Portland, Oregon. This is our 31st year in business. We have 10 full-time employees, one part-time. I also happen to be a member of a statewide small business organization called Main Street Alliance of Oregon, and I'm the statewide co-chair. This issue has, in our polling, in our discussions with our members we represent about 2,100 businesses statewide. In our discussions, there is and in our polling, we found considerable concern among the small businesses, because most of our businesses that we have are very small, have very little preparation, very few resources for retirement. Many of them and their employees are ill-prepared and recognize that and haven't much of an idea about what to do about that. And so my hope is that we can make use of the resources of this group take these ideas back to the people that the small businesses around the state that we talk with, that we're in conversation with, and come up with a plan that will help them see the possibility for a better future as they age, as their employees think about retirement. I mean, we have our own employees. We have our first employee that we hired retired 2 years ago after 29 years.
Wow.
Fortunately, her husband had, through his business, had defined benefits. But we have one person with 24 years who's retiring in May, and he's already setting up reverse mortgage, and he's 68, and he can't figure out quite what they're going to make of the future. Even though we have a simple IRA, it's going to be a problem for him.
Thank you, Jim. Jan, can you tell us? Jan is the administrator for this committee. The legislature, being very kind to us, has given us somebody who's tremendously well-organized and focused and knowledgeable on this subject. Jan, can you tell us a little bit about your background and your thoughts?
I will. I work in the legislature's nonpartisan committee staff office, so I'm staffing committees in addition to this. I bring to the job a master's in public administration and a bachelor's in economics, and I've been doing this job for about 7 years.
Great.
And I'm available to any member that wants to contact me if there's questions about process, if there's questions about material or needing help finding something, please feel free to contact me directly.
Thank you. And Debbie, can you tell us a little bit about your role as well?
I'm Debbie Malone, the committee assistant, and I do the paperwork.
And you have a little placard that's lit up in front of you. What does that mean?
means that you're being recorded.
Ah, okay, so this is all public meeting, and Jan's going to tell us a little bit about that later as well.
Dick, if you could
jump in.
Sure, I'm Richard, or Dick Schwartz. I just retired last year, so I find myself in that milieu of figuring out how to manage my funds and retirement life. I retired after 24 years as the executive director of the American Federation of Teachers, Oregon, and having spent 35 years altogether as a field representative or assistant director or director for this state. In a prior life was a newspaper reporter. And in throughout all of that experience, have waded through a life of changed employment settings, as people talk about it. It's influencing this kind of issue from employer to employer of varying size. And also in my experience as an executive director, I was a manager of the institution that for all practical purposes was or is a small business employer with about 10 employees who had to face all of the same questions about finding and managing a pension plan for a small business and those employees so they would have some sense of what their retirement security would be. And so I approach this from the collection of all that experience and hope that we can answer some of the questions that form the basis for the need for exploring this and come up with some recommendations that the legislature will accept.
Very good. Thanks, Dick. I appreciate it. And Anne, it's good to see you again.
Thank you. You too. I'm Anne Leininger, and I most recently took on the role of being a state legislator, but that is not why I was invited to serve on this board. I actually, I think that what I bring, in addition to enthusiasm for this topic, that may be the reason I'm serving with you today, is that I'm a vice president and general counsel of Oregon Iron Works, which is a manufacturing company that employs close to 500 people, probably over 75% of whom are union employees in the production part of the company, and then a significant number of people who do administrative and paper and analytical work to support our production processes. And that body of people does not start having access to a retirement opportunity. And so there's, in fact, you know, while this is a great company that works really hard to provide health care for employees and their families and sick time and a lot of great things, you don't start out as a non-represented employee having access to a retirement savings program, which I myself have experienced, and it presented some challenges. And so I'm interested from an employer standpoint in how we can make sure that people who are working hard and doing a great job have access to the kinds of vehicles they need to save. And I'm also interested as a mother and woman in the workforce who's working part-time in the fact that a lot of women who are retired have many fewer resources than others. And I read some interesting statistics that 57% of all Oregon retirees are women, and 83% of the people in the bottom quartile of income as retirees are women. And I think one of my hopes in this process is that we help make sure that working people have an opportunity to save, and then we make sure that we tailor something that working women who may spend time in and out of the workforce can use as a savings tool too, because we're living for a long time and we need to find a way to pay our way.
Thanks, Ian. I appreciate it. Harley?
Harley Spring, Vice President of Retirement Plans at the Standard. As you know, we're a 160-year-old Oregon-based company, so it's great to be here. You know, probably what I bring is just the knowledge of nationally what's going on with retirement plans. We do all different types of retirement plans, including 403Bs for nonprofits, as well as for the defined contributions, as well as defined benefits. You know, this is extremely important to us. We are actively helping and trying to find ways to help people retire. That is our goal for every employer that we work with. and really trying to find those hidden silver bullets that allow people to make it easier and make it something that's just ingrained in what they're thinking about. So this is exciting times for us as well.
Thanks. Well, I appreciate everybody's participation. Obviously, we have different perspectives and backgrounds, and I think that'll be very useful as the process of the task force unfolds. And for you folks, I just want to say, if I didn't already, that we will always have public comment at the end of every one of these meetings. I think if you're making the effort to be here and follow what we're doing, you obviously have an interest, which means you probably have a perspective, and we'd like to hear it. So we'll save time at every one of the meetings for public comment. Jan, if you could be so kind, we have something fairly ominous on our agenda here that says adoption of task force rules and public meeting requirements. Could you take a few minutes and just walk us through that so we're all clear on what is required of us in that regard?
It's not ominous. It's really not.
Excellent.
In your pack, pretty much at the top, is the proposed rules. These are standard rules that the legislature uses, and I want to point out just a few, make a few comments on Rule 4 about the quorum. You need a quorum to conduct your business, but the chair can have public testimony accepted with fewer than the quorum. Also, since it's a public body, you cannot meet outside of a noticed meeting if there are four of you or more. That would be a quorum, so you can't get together for lunch with four or five to talk about business related to the task force. We mentioned that the meetings are recorded, and through the OLIS system, people can go back and listen to those hearings. They can listen now anywhere across the country, but also they're archived, so you can listen at any time if you wanted to catch something that was confusing at the moment. So all of our meetings, they are open to public meetings. They all have to be noticed, and we shoot for at least 24 hours notice. That's not much, but that is the requirement. And I also want to point out that that any recommendations that come out, the rules are calling for a majority of the appointed members to approve those recommendations. Are there any questions about these rules?
Any questions, concerns, things that we should add, things that we should omit? Great. Just so that we have adopted these rules formally, could I please get a motion and a second to adopt these rules?
I'll move adoption. Thanks.
I'll second.
So Dick moves and seconds. All in favor, vote aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Great. We have rules.
And Mr. Chair, I'll just point out, rule number three is that we don't require seconds for any motion. So.
Already.
No breaking any rules.
So much for the rules. Moving right along. Expectations of the task force.
Well, Mr. Chair, committee members, I put before you a copy of the bill. I didn't know if everyone had seen the actual language that created this task force. But to make it just a little bit more readable, I put together one page that's titled Oregon Retirement Savings Task Force, and it outlines the directions for this task force. At the top is the basic role for this task force is to develop the recommendations by September 2014 for increasing the percentage of Oregons that are saving for retirement or enrolled in a retirement plan and for increasing the amount of those individual savings. Then the document outlines those things that the legislature told this task force to consider at a minimum. Some of them are about access and the types of plans that are available. They want the task force to estimate the amount of savings that citizens are making and make recommendations as to what those levels should be, to look at tax incentive issues, to look at possible education and marketing strategies. And then to get kind of into the nuts and bolts, to look at some possible structures of plans and products that could be offered or facilitated by the state, and then look at the advantages and disadvantages of those plans. You're also being asked to look at the costs of structures of the plans that are already available to Oregon citizens, and to look at what it would take to create a public-private partnership in Oregon that offers plans or products directly to individuals. and the adoption expansion of successful approaches used to increase participation in retirement plans. And the legislature was carefully laid out what this task force may not do. Legislature says that the task force is not to recommend any particular plan or product that's going to subject the state or a private employer to any kind of liability or obligation, or that is going to fall under the responsibilities of ERISA, and also that any recommended plans are not going to create any financial obligation for the private employer. I think I already said that. The private employer or the state can't have any guarantee and can't be subject to any liability. And then it is clear that the group is to report by September 1, 2014. It's not specific to who you'll be reporting to. It's the appropriate interim committee of the Legislative Assembly. The bill that traveled through the House Business and Labor Committee and the Senate Business and Transportation Committee, so those might be the two committees that this report will end up before.
And we'll get some clarity on that, and also the how of it. It's not specified, is it, how we report, whether it's a written report or an oral report?
Mr. Chair, it is not.
Okay, good. And so my assumption is, as we get closer to September, we'll get some clarity from the legislative leadership in terms of how they'd like us to present our findings.
And the bill does not give the task force any authority to have legislation drafted. Sometimes you'll see that in a task force or a committee, but this committee does not. It's only to make recommendations.
Question on what the task force may not do. As I read this, it says that we are not to recommend any products or strategies or plans that subject either the state of Oregon or private sector employers to liability under ERISA, meaning that I'm just trying to clarify when it says no liability, it's meaning specifically as stated in ERISA, as opposed to no liability.
It says it would not subject the state of Oregon or the private employers to responsibilities under ERISA. I don't know if that.
So I probably won't take your time. Since I was not part of the legislative crew that drafted that particular language, I might ask for a legislative clarification as to what they meant specifically about that, because personally I've been chewing on that one all morning. That and a lack of seconds. I don't know, Ann. You know, at the county where we have all these seconds, it seems so thorough. But that's all right. Any other questions that people have with regard to this? Concerns? Good things?
I have a question maybe an aid of the Legislative Council question. The way I read the plain language of this, plan would mean a specific specific retirement plan, and products would mean whatever retirement products there might be. I raise that because I think you use the word strategies, but I don't see that.
That's correct. You're correct. Products and plans. Strategies is not part of that. Thank you for the clarification. Mm-hmm. Anything else?
And Ted, do you have a specific concern or?
No, I wanted to know how to read that sentence. And what I'm really getting at is legislative intent.
Right. Yep.
And for the time being, I'm taking it literally, which to me says it is definitely meaning in the context of ERISA and liabilities as they would be outlined under federal statute. But I don't know if that was actually the intent of what they meant. So I want to clarify that for the committee before we go too far down the road. So everybody's clear on the what and the whys. Okay, good. So Jan, reporting, is there anything specific, or are you referring back to reporting to the legislative body?
Just the timeline, right. Just September 1st is the timeline for this. Throw out there that if the group was hoping for legislation to be drafted, the legislature has a pre-session filing deadline, a deadline to request legislation by September 21st, I believe it is.
Very good. Thank you. So we've been given a fairly clear path to follow by the legislature in terms of minimum requirements and what we must cover and information that must be gathered. And obviously, we've already begun at the staff level to try and assemble some of that. What we had proposed in terms of meetings, understanding how these things typically work over the course of the summer, we have this meeting today. We would propose three informational meetings, so approximately one per month. We would then have a total of five meetings, so we'd have this one, we'd have three informational meetings, and then one sort of final wrap-up recommendation meeting. If we needed additional meetings, and as a group we collectively agreed that we needed additional meetings or an additional meeting, we could certainly choose to do that. My proposal would be that we not schedule a meeting during August, only because I know that's folly. If we try it, it's not going to happen. So if we can do one, you know, the next three on a monthly basis and be pretty diligent about it, take August off, and be ready to report back in September, that's probably the best way to do it, if I could suggest that. Does that seem to square with people's expectations? There's no reason that subcommittees couldn't be formed if people felt there were particular subjects that needed additional insight or additional research. A group of two, or I guess, Jan, right, potentially three?
Yes, potentially three.
Could meet as a subcommittee, do some additional research, and come back and report to the full body on any particular subject of interest. And I certainly want to leave that flexibility to do so if people feel that that's necessary. So that's good. And what we'll do is we'll have Jan reach out to all of us, and we'll find the dates where we're all collectively available to do that. That shouldn't be too hard to do. So, context of the issue. I don't necessarily want to dwell too long on this. I certainly want Dick to weigh in because I know he's been part of this. I want to start off by saying that in addition to this being an important issue, this is not the first time that the state legislature has raised the question of retirement security. Going back, three treasurers, Treasurer Jim Hilt convened a similar committee at the request of the legislature back in the 1990s. They did extensive research. They held a number of meetings. They issued a report, which I think everybody has received a copy of.
Yes.
The context was very different. As I go back and I read that report, this was pre-media obsession and focus on public pensions, and so the question the legislature actually asked the committee to look at was whether or not private sector citizens should be participating to some degree in the public pension program, whether it was directly invested in the public pension program, which I think today we can pretty safely say is not legal, or whether they were going to create a mirror tool that people could invest in where they would be making similar investments to what was in the investment pool around the public employee retirement fund. And I think they looked at that and decided that that wasn't a very cost-effective way to do it. They looked at increasing citizen awareness of retirement security and the importance of long-term savings. And so that was something where they landed on as sort of a no-brainer, that yes, they should do more around just informing people about the importance of retirement security and getting young people to really start thinking about retirement security, even though they had other immediate economic priorities that maybe would make them think not to do that. So we have had that effort here. The issue is obviously heated up in recent years, in my opinion, in large measure because of the focus on public employee retirement plans. It's gotten everybody to start thinking about what is their own retirement situation like. And I painted something of a picture and brought up some other issues that I believe when we look at the data in Oregon, we will see that women are disproportionately affected by a lack of retirement security. We'll see the same thing is true with minority communities, and we'll see that small business employees tend to undersave for retirement as well. And as a small business state, that's something that should probably be of interest to us. But there are other states that have different politics, that have different views on the role of government in this question, that are taking different tacks. In your materials, you have a lengthy list of states and actions that are being undertaken by states. And just quickly, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. Looks like 14 or 15 states, including Oregon, are actively looking at the question of retirement security. So we are not going it alone, we are closely following what other states are looking at and what we're doing, and we're going to make some of that information available to you to the extent that we think we can learn from what other states are discussing and ideas that they're batting around as well. Dick, I don't know if you have more to add to the question of history or what's going on in other states, but you've certainly, through AFT and through your own work, have been very actively involved in this over the years.
I would just add that updating the data in the 1997 Treasurer's Report probably would be helpful, since at least two things have occurred. One, the financial meltdown in 2008 and since. And second, to get a better handle on what has happened, if anything, with the demographics in the state, that certainly would touch on the gender, income, poverty level, financial wherewithal of the citizens. Both a profile and averages would help us have a database or basis for comparing what the data from 1997 has changed to in 2014. There's a second report from the Oregon State Treasury in April of 2011 that does a lot of numeric comparisons, which may be the one that updates the one in 1997, but even in the last 3 years, numbers have certainly changed that relate to the profile of economic security in this state. And I think reading all of this, and there's plenty of material that goes, I even found one document from England that it was a study on ways to incentivize investment in retirement by its citizens. So this state, other states, and other countries are looking at this at the same time. And I think at the bottom we should remember that whatever we recommend, I think would be helpful for us to recognize that the recommendation probably is only useful to those who have the resources, and that we have a larger social context, and that is those without resources or living day-to-day and paycheck to paycheck. While we may be able to address how to rearrange some of those their expenses with an eye toward some education for the need to save for the future, that if people are scratching day in and day out just to make it by, that our recommendations will go right by them, and we will be preserving the difficulties for a certain segment of the population into the future. So the entire financial context or wherewithal that people have in this state is a factor that we will have to take into account to some, or at least recognize in the whatever set of recommendations we take, and what are issues that influence those circumstances and those conditions that prevent them from saving for the future or assist them in savings for their future.
Very good. Other thoughts? Great. Okay, so here's the meat of today's meeting. And you've all been asked to think about this. If we have the next three meetings being testimony, and certainly with Jan and Tom and James, who are here from my team, and others, we can come up with what we think are some pretty meaty ideas about what good presentations would be, but we really want you to guide that conversation. So I'd like to at least kick off the conversation about, and Dick, I think, has done a good job of suggesting that we update the 97 task force information so that we can see longitudinally what's happened. And while I suspect I know the answer to that question, it would actually be good to have the data to back it. I'd like to hear from you what you think would be useful information for us to present over the next three meetings. And also, we have a lot of community partners here in the room. And Joyce, I know in a few minutes when it's public testimony, you're going to give us some ideas here and others. This is an opportunity, I think, for us to lean on community partners who also have data to experiences and information about certain populations in this state that could be helpful to us as a task force as well. But I'd love to hear from you guys what kind of information you'd like to have in order to be able to fulfill the goals that Jan outlined.
May I throw one in?
Absolutely.
The one that seems to be most closely watched is the one that was adopted in California in 2012. That's the one that seems to be the furthest along. The table, I think, shows that some of those that have been introduced in other states in 2013 and 2014 have failed in various committees and are legislators or for the politics for one reason or another. But the California one seems to have the longest run so far. So it might be helpful if we heard from somebody who had some experience with that or some contact with people with experience in it to tell us what the upside and the downside of that plan is. And I believe it's passed, and I'm not necessarily well informed on this one, but I believe that it has passed muster with ERISA and is not running afoul of that.
So we can do that, and it might actually be helpful, Jan, if I could just get us to elaborate on some of these proposals. Some of these proposals are, I'll just be honest, are pretty thin that other states have worked on. Some of them are what I would call check-the-box legislation, and then everybody moves on and calls it a day. Other states are actually being very aggressive in terms of how they do this. I know Indiana's state treasurer, Republican, had pushed a fairly aggressive bill that never got out of committee. It was sort of the same story. But there were some interesting ideas to be learned there from a state that I would describe as fairly restrictive in its view of the role of government. Other states like Connecticut, I think Connecticut is in the process of doing something similar to the state of California. Their legislature is still in session. I don't know what the fate of that particular bill will be. I know there's strong support for it, and there's also heated opposition to it. But it would be interesting, I think, for us to learn from those states. One area where I think the legislature in Oregon did us a tremendous service is they didn't jump to the answer. They really gave us an opportunity to see what's going on this session in all of these states and to weigh what they're doing and hear their arguments and see the data that they're putting forward to help inform our decision. And there's also some information going on at the federal level that I think is useful. So I'd like to see a deeper conversation about what other states are looking at and what is presumed to be legal and meets the requirements and sideboards that the legislature put on this body.
You know, I think it's possible that two of us did not get this packet, or maybe more than two of us.
Yeah.
It looks like a really good piece of information, though, so if there were a way to get that comparative state-by-state
put it up right away.
Thanks.
Jan, is everything that we're looking at, does this go onto a website somewhere? Or is
it
there?
Does. I think I sent a memo out to everybody yesterday. We use OLIS. It's the legislature's online website. The task force has its own website. It's you'll see the agendas there. We will post everything. So we have today's testimony. There's probably a dozen and a half pieces of testimony that's posted there. And we will go back and as soon as the meeting is over, add that document that's missing.
Good. Yeah.
I'm very interested in seeing how the California work is moving forward, especially if it's perceived to be viable. But you know, any state that's doing work that's kind of broadly accepted within that state, that seems to be a good starting place. I think that's a great idea. I would also love to hear more about the issue of the possible gap between the existing products that individuals can access outside of employment, and the community that is generally not saving as much as it could be. You know, where is there a mismatch? Is there is it simply a question of information access? Is it possible that there are wonderful products that currently exist, but they may not meet the needs of people who are really mobile in their employment or other things? I'd love to hear about that.
Related to that, having just heard some testimony at the federal level, I'd like to know what specifically in Oregon are the impediments to retirement savings. Given the amount of information that's been out there for years, why are people still not retiring? Do we have some substantive data or polling information, something that we can sink our teeth into that gives us a clear answer to that question? It just seems to me if we know the answer to that question with clarity, that helps us understand what we're trying to fix, right?
Well, and I wonder if there's something to this piece about the larger social context and looking at who are those folks that aren't retiring and is there a resource issue? And if it's a resource issue and the recommendations, you know, thinking about are the recommendations going to fall on deaf ears essentially because they don't have the resource to put into retirement, so that's why they aren't thinking about it. What does that mean for the recommendations? And thinking beyond folks that have the extra income at the end of the month, but thinking about all of those people with any income to be thinking, to be looking at what that monthly budget entails, and if it's not an employer-based program, where can those dollars come from?
One of the things I'd like to understand and develop a better understanding of are the different approaches, the different types of products, the different strategies, one being the, I think it's called the defined contribution, but where you as an individual save periodically and build your retirement, and then at retirement you have to kind of predict how you're going to use that, where it's going to go. And what happens to in the real world during downturns, for example, whether people stop contributing, whether they pull it out, what that strategy versus the one like PERS or like the college savings plan or like that Oregon has or like Social Security, where that actually can have a bigger positive influence during a downturn because it's something that's built into the system that you have a guaranteed a payment for life that isn't dependent on what you personally were able to save individually, to kind of understand what are the strengths and weaknesses of those and how, and to the degree can we have both or to some degree or should we lean more toward one or toward the other?
That's good. I have three more that I would add to the list. One, I don't know that we can answer it. What are the implications of the status quo? In other words, if we go back to the legislature and say, here's a potpourri of ideas from which presumably they can choose what they want to choose, what is effectively the cost of doing nothing? What are the implications of doing nothing? Is it a big deal, a medium deal, a small deal? Is there any way to quantify it? Is there any way to predict it or project it? And yeah, we certainly have some national statistics. I don't know, frankly, whether those have been drilled down to a state level based on the structure of our own economy, our population, poverty rates, demographics, and the like. But if that information were there, or if we were able to make a reasonable estimate of it, I think that would be really useful. I don't remember if you did that happen in the 97 task force. Was there any?
They used the current population survey from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, I think, Department of Labor, and then I think the numbers they used were 1995 numbers. Okay. And the current population survey is updated fairly regularly. I think the most recent one that I was able to see was 2011.
Okay.
The data is available but requires that you can break down or make some effort to break down by state, but it requires downloading some massive data files that are in a specific format and somebody to go through. I think the Economic Policy Institute did a paper on Oregon retirement security recently and was able to take the data from that current population survey and crunch those numbers.
Very good. Thanks, Dick. That looks like a good report. Two others. Number one, I would like to know what incentives are successful versus not successful in encouraging retirement savings. And I would guess that there's a ton of data out there, right, Harley? There's got to be plenty of data out there on that. And then thirdly, just looking at structures, what structures are successful? And I understand we're not supposed to suggest a plan or a product, but it would be helpful to lay out for the legislative body what kind of structures are actually successful in encouraging retirement savings. By structures, I mean things like payroll deduction.
Mm-hmm.
We heard a lot in the congressional testimony about automation being really important. We heard about scaling up as being very important. And if there's information out there on what kind of structures are successful, that would be particularly useful to me.
May I
jump
extend
in?
That?
Yeah, you got it.
There was some U.S. Senate testimony, and you may be aware of it, I think it was U.S. Senate, that had testimony from representatives of very ethnic group organizations. And there were statistics and studies provided by each of those groups on participation and opt-in or opt-out type plans that varied among those groups. So there may be data out there that will reach into both your question and the issues that Ann raised earlier.
That data is pretty widely available. I mean, an auto enrollment type program is definitely going to be your highest participation. And then just how much is your savings rate? It's the next step. So, yeah, but that data is pretty available.
I think U of O has a labor education and research center, and they may be a resource for. I mean, it sounds like something that would be down their alley.
Yeah, the good news for all of this is, I suspect what Harley says is, the implication. I think the data is all out there. I think this has been studied to death in terms of where we are and what works and what doesn't work, and it's a matter of being able to get it here into an easy-to-compile format that we can rather quickly take a look at and decide what works and what doesn't with the guidelines that have been established by the legislature. I mean, from my perspective, I think we can create, as I say, a menu of options that meet the guidelines that have been proposed. And somewhere in all of this, somebody's going to ask about the cost. If we do something like auto-enroll, somebody's going to certainly raise their hand and say, well, if I'm a private business owner and I have 10 employees, what does that mean for me? What do I have to do to actually have an auto-enroll plan in my place of employment? I think that's relevant information, too.
I have a question about the issue of how much we're supposed to not define and point to possible strategies. And you know, as a layperson who is thinking about ways my own savings has been sort of made enabled by government structures, I think about how we're trying to save for our kids college and how we have a productive auto deduction that we signed up for that puts money into 529 plan accounts for both of the kids. It doesn't seem impossibly complicated to be administered. I think it is managed by the private sector and it's helping us. And you know, would it be inappropriate for us to think about, you know, the costs and benefits of models, a variety of models, one of which could be that, as we're doing our work? And if it would be prohibitively specific, I guess it leaves me kind of confused about how we can be helpful if we can't think about actual ways it might work.
So I actually completely agree that we should look at strategies like that. I believe, Jan, didn't the legislature specifically say look at tax incentives?
It does. It says that you're to look at tax incentives currently offered in the state to encourage retirement.
Right.
Savings.
And you know, I can tell you that, you know, this is a conversation that's taking place at the federal level. They're looking at the same lengthy list of states taking this up. They know a good issue when they see one. And the question from Congress's perspective is, okay, different states are going to come up with different solutions based on their own politics and needs and demographics. But what could we do from an umbrella perspective to help encourage what the states are trying to do, regardless of what their individual plans may or may not look like? And the 529 piece has definitely been proffered as one suggestion. Give the states the ability to provide tax incentives. And if we want to take a look at that, I don't see why we wouldn't do that. By the same token, I think we can take a look at what exists here in the state and what might, you know, the Oregonian did an editorial the other day, and although I generally try not to do this, I did look at the comments, and a number of the comments were serious suggestions. Well, you know, if I could deduct it from my Oregon income taxes, I'd be more likely to save for retirement. Yeah. Maybe there are other ideas out there. I don't know. But I think it's totally appropriate for us to do that. In my opinion, I don't know. What does everybody else think?
I agree wholeheartedly. I think the way I read plan and product would be, plan would be a specific kind of plan that's out there, like a Simple or SEP IRA, or a product would be a Vanguard or Fidelity IRA. But I don't think anything that I've heard here today moves us in it toward any of those. But I think certainly laying out for comparison purposes, for the benefit of the legislators, if there were a state program, here's what it might look like, so that they have the legislators have some reasonable context in evaluating whatever the recommendations are we might have. It certainly would make sense if we're going to make any reference to any of the other state programs or successes, for example, if the California one is rated a success. And I would encourage us to move in the direction of some way to measure whatever recommendations we have. And you mentioned the 529 program. That's a successful one. Is there something that might fall into place or might be able to be structured that we could examine like that for purposes of retirement?
I think along with that, or coupled with it, We also need to always have on the table what are the effective education pieces that need to go with this, with these products, plans, strategies, whatever they are. I know there's a lot of research happening right now. After an economic downturn, we start to ask the questions of how did this happen? Foreclosures, how did that happen? Was it an education problem? Did people know what they were getting into? And having an understanding of what works and what doesn't for folks, what do they pay attention to? Is there a reason that they aren't, is there an understanding issue? What are the basics of financial education around retirement that we need to make sure people really understand on a level that is so basic that it doesn't get into the fine print, it doesn't get into any of the complications, but really starts to send the message of it's important because this is your future after working. And be coupling every single piece of opportunity with what's the education needed to go with it. How do we help people understand the importance of the issue? How do we help them make the right decision, make a decision that's both transparent and helps them make the best choice? We see this in the financial markets, helping people get into the financial mainstream. There's a group of folks working on a bank-on product and trying to figure out how do we help those who really are afraid of financial mainstream understand the benefits of doing that versus not. You're paying more in some ways. In this case, you're working longer. You're living a different life after work if you choose not to save. How do we create education that that captures people's attention in a new way? And what's that going to take in Oregon?
And how we would pay for it.
Right.
Sorry, treasures always have to end every sense of how we're going to pay for it.
Good. Anything else?
I have two items. One is, what is the data or of the impact on public services by retirees who are not well prepared to subsist in retirement? And there may be numbers on utilization of food stamp programs or others. And the second one is, are there barriers? And if so, if there are, what are they? And can they be overcome that would permit similarly situated small employers from grouping together for pension programs for their employees across their specific employer.
And there's a good overlap here again with the federal policy. This panel I was participating in had one expert from a national bank who was talking about the 401k and IRA plans that her company sold. And she suggested a number of structural and legal obstacles that had been created in the market that they would love to see the federal government roll back. And I can't talk intelligently about what those specific impediments were, but I got the sense that there are things that happen at the federal level, and there are probably things that happen at the state level that are, in fact, structural or legal impediments to retirement savings. And it would be useful to try and identify what some of those are.
And the federal level is usually out of the Department of Labor. That's where a lot of that's coming from.
Department of Labor. Thanks, Harv.
If I could just say, even employer associations, like the Small Business Alliance, or if they could be a sponsor, for example, of a plan for their member organizations.
You know, that's a good point, because I noticed as I was scanning this list, a number of states, as they introduced legislation, weren't talking about global plans. They were talking in some cases about very specific plans for specific populations. Here's one. In Massachusetts, House Bill 3754 creates a state-sponsored 401k for nonprofits with 20 employees or less to be administered by the state treasurer. So there are some who just took a look at one segment that was a noticeable large gap and focused narrowly on that. Other states have copied California. Other states have created their own global plans
or at least are in the process of discussing the creation of a global plan is probably a fair way of putting it. So there's lots of different ways that we could potentially dice this. Jan, I had a question. In the legislation, the plans are, we are focused specifically on voluntary plans. Is that correct? Was that a sideboard? Or am I mistaken about that?
I don't think that shows up anywhere.
Okay. But it probably, we back into it, though, through the ERISA liability, right?
And through, you cannot recommend a plan or product that creates a financial obligation, a liability, or a guarantee on the part of an employer. So,
for savings or benefits earned by plan participants, it goes on to say.
Mm-hmm.
So,
could we get a clarification on that? That'd be helpful. Thanks. Good. Anything else? All right, well, this is not the end of this conversation. I'm sure as people read up on materials and have conversations, other ideas are going to come to the fore. Feel free to email me anytime or email Jan or pick up the phone, give me a call. And I'm happy, by the way, after the meeting to share my cell phone number with you guys if that would be helpful too. I will not read it into the record. That's all right, Debbie. By the way, Debbie, I have a question for you. Do legislators have a history of stealing these pens? What's with this?
Right, I noticed that.
I mean, that's sad. That is a sad commentary of these dark and troubled times in which we live.
You got a chip in it.
It's like a 10-cent pen. That's awesome. All right, good. So we are then at the... Is there anything else for the good of the order before I open up any public testimony? I know we have at least one person who's interested in testifying today. Great. So how many people are interested in public testimony today? So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Can people do it in 3 minutes or less? Within, you know, give, I'm not going to absolutely cut you off because we have plenty of time, but if you could keep it about 3 minutes, I'd appreciate it. And Debbie, are all the mics up? Are both of those live? Okay, maybe if we could come up just three at a time, we'll make it informal. If you could state your name for the record, since people who listen to the testimony want to know who's giving the testimony, I'd appreciate it. You don't need to give your address or anything like that, just your name for the record. And Joyce, would you like to go first since we kindly have, and thank you for preparing our written testimony. It's very helpful.
Oh, good. Treasurer Wheeler and members of the task force, my name is Joyce DeMonna, and I'm the outreach director with AARP Oregon. And today I'm here with a member of our volunteer executive council, Dr. Daniel Rodriguez, who has worked with me for a number of years on retirement security issues, and I'm really glad to have him with us. But I do want to make one little side mark off my prepared comments that I spent a really scintillating Wednesday evening watching Treasurer Wheeler and Senator Merkley at the hearing last week.
We need to get you better television.
It was very, very interesting, and I think one of the things that of the comments that I heard that was so fascinating was, you know, how difficult it is for individual accounts to earn the same kind of return on investment as pooled accounts. And to me, that was a little bit of an aha moment about some of the things we're struggling with. I did want to make just open today, you know, just talking about, you know, how concerned AARP is about this unprecedented retirement savings crisis in America today, that we're looking at $6.6 trillion or $57,000 a household in deficit for retirement savings. And we know that in spite of some people are doing well, but Americans are very anxious, about 84% being very concerned about economic conditions and the global uncertainty and how that impacts our ability to achieve a secure retirement as more and more risk has been shifted from the corporation to provide retirement security to individual risk to plan and save for it. We know that currently 1 in 10 Oregonians 65 or older lives in poverty, and half of those 65 and older had an annual individual income of less than $18,500. And I think we heard today that the CEO for Oracle is making $20,000 an hour. So that's kind of an interesting comparison. And that was from SEIU, so thank you for that, Matt. Nearly 41% of Oregonians, 65 population, would have incomes below the poverty line if they did not receive Social Security, and 30% of Oregonians rely on it as their only source of income. And that's really problematic, and it's something that we at AARP have been working on. And some people just don't realize, like Elena said, how much they need to save for retirement. It is clear that workers are not prepared for retirement, and as the baby boomers continue to retire, we will see the crisis grow unless we act now. And Boston College's National Retirement Risk Index estimates that 53% of households face an insecure retirement, meaning that they will run the risk of running out of essentials such as food, medicine, or utilities. I'm not going to go into every little detail on here, but we are really worried about this at AARP, and many of you may have seen last year we issued a survey, and we showed that 1 in 6 Oregonians had a savings less than $5,000 who were aged 45 to 64. And I think the USA Today just came out and said something like a third of Americans have less than $1,000 in retirement savings. So we really have a savings deficit in America. And, you know, I think when we have this big of a problem, it's not just an individual problem. It's a societal problem we all have to work on. And I might conclude by just commenting on Mr. Schwartz's comment about what is this going to mean for the long term when we have a lot of seniors retiring into poverty. And I was not able to pull that information today. I didn't have enough time. But I think when we look at what the state Medicaid budget is now, and it is a big chunk of the state budget, what it will be when, if 1 in 10 people retire into poverty, it will really take a big chunk of our state Medicaid budget, and we have to look at that as maybe potentially one of the unintended consequences of not dealing with this issue have for the task force. So with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Rodriguez.
Lest you think this isn't a problem locally, in Oregon, 42% of workers do not even have access to a retirement plan. Planning for retirement is an even greater burden for economically disadvantaged groups, people of color, young people, and part-time employees, because they have the lowest access to employer-sponsored retirement plans. If nothing is done now, the state budget will be saddled with a growing burden as the future older forces are forced to rely more and more on public safety programs. We believe this is a pressing issue for our communities, our state, and our union. As such, retirement security is one of AARP's top priority for 2014 and beyond. We believe this is of such importance that we urge the task force to make these meetings as accessible to the public, which thankfully you have done, Chairman Wheeler. It's commendable this working is happening in Oregon. I would also like to share with you some of the work that AARP has undertaken in other states. We have attached a synopsis of recently enacted and considered legislation, as you have in front of you, appendices A and B. AARP believes that we all have the right to live with self-reliance and dignity in retirement. Our local and national staff are willing to help you in this important work. And yes, they will make a presentation to your committee here. We believe a sense of urgency is required to meet this challenge head on, and by working together, we can bring retirement into reach for all Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Treasurer Wheeler and members of the task force. My name is Matt Swanson. I work with the Service Employees International Union, Oregon State Council. I think that I submitted some written testimony. There'll be some statistics and other things in there that I won't bore you with right now. I can probably record that later if you need a sleep aid. Where I think this is really important for us, and where I kind of hit home for me, is we work with about 25,000 care providers in the state who provide services for low-income seniors and people with disabilities. Oftentimes, people associate SEIU very closely with PERS, and certainly we're proud of the work we do to try to improve retirement security for all Oregonians, and especially members who have access to that kind of plan. But with our home care workforce in particular, these are folks who
don't have a plan through their work typically make very little. They've made improvement in their wages, but are really the type of workforce who sees their future every day through their work. And what I mean by that is they see someone who usually was a low-income person, typically a woman too. We talked about the gender gap here, but typically it's a low-income woman caring for a low-income woman. And what we've seen is that without access, and that work has transitioned over time from independent contractor into a more stable type of employment, but they have not made improvements around retirement. And especially in rural communities, you would imagine where we used to have mills and people retired with a good pension, it's now the top workforces in healthcare, caring for the aging logger, perhaps, with the home care worker who has no secure retirement of their own. So this is very important to us in that regard, and I think we commend you for taking up this work because, you know, for these workers, they're part of that tsunami of retirees coming our way that we need to figure out how do we find a way to really secure their financial future or at least bring them out of poverty. So with that in mind, I think I want to go through just a few of the principles I would look at. I think obviously we've talked about that many of us are aging and the current system, while it has ample options, is not working for everybody. And there are a number of reasons and factors I think that go into that. And you should certainly look at, you know, why do these products, while they're out there, why are they not getting to all workers? I think one important piece of that is just the nature of work has changed. We know that you don't go work at the mill for 30 years, retire with your pension and a watch, and right off into the sunset. I think especially, you know, I like to still count myself young. But younger workers, they work a number of jobs. They've moved around a lot. They don't have the same relationship with that employer, so the type of retirement that they need differs much from what their parents had. So what I like to think of is, when you look at the plans that are out there, what are the best elements of a defined contribution and a defined benefit system, and how could they match up in a report? So I put some general principles that I think we would be interested in, but voluntary participation is certainly part of that. But I think in the private sector, they've developed some ways to, you know, through an opt-out or you're enrolled, everyone gets a plan, but it's your choice to stay in. I think Oregonians want voluntary participation in their plans, but we should find a way to also make it easy and kind of push back on the inertia about when consumers have a lot of choices, many times they won't act rationally, right? They may just choose to do nothing. Portability and flexibility, of course, I think for younger workers, and just the reality of what our work is these days. I think that's the norm for many younger workers and older workers, frankly. Mm-hmm. So that sort of portability and flexibility would be helpful to plan, and was not always the hallmark of the traditional pension plan. You couldn't necessarily take that with you. Professionally managed and pooled investments. I think Treasurer Wheeler has talked about that, and I think that is important for most investors, is to have that better efficiency and, you know, market heft. I think that gives them more bang for their buck, and frankly is something that should be considered when you look at plans. Keeping the costs low. You know, I think what Oregonians rate plans, they should look at cost as an issue. I don't really have an arbitrary line on that, but I just think it's something that we should be transparent around and educate consumers on. Because I think that's, as a consumer who's looked into plans, that's probably the most confusing piece. So whatever you report on, some education about how cost works and just whatever you would recommend, I think that's an important piece. Universally available, especially to the part-time workforce, people in transition. We talked about, women who perhaps take time out of the workforce to care for a child, or someone who takes time out of the workforce to care for a parent. Can they still have a way to have a plan that would be accessible, you know, even while they aren't participating in the workforce? I think that's important. And then looking at what are the best strategies to create a lifetime stream of income. So annuities, what policies work in terms of, I guess, discouraging withdrawals. How do we make sure that when you talk about retirement accounts, it's not like a savings account, that this is actually a little different as a product? I would also recommend that we look to work with the federal delegation. You'll hear a lot about ERISA. I think ERISA is a big, complicated law, much like our tax code. And anyone who argues definitively about what ERISA means or does not mean for the plans, I think, is guessing. I don't think that we've actually made it all the way through. California has probably gotten the furthest. They have a request for information out there. I don't think they have a definitive answer. So anyone who argues otherwise is just wrong or has prematurely projected their own interest onto this argument. I think what I would recommend there is to actually ask the California Treasury to come up and present the bulk of the information. I think we're looking at advantages and disadvantages, so don't let this become an impenetrable wall. Let it be a guidepost and learn. From my perspective, I think if the state should do something, obviously it should be an onerous plan because otherwise they'd be preempted. Preemption means that it wouldn't pass go and there wouldn't be any responsibilities on employers anyhow. Finally, the workplace is really central. I think that's important. We know that most workers will save through their workplace, but they're much less likely to do so outside the workplace. It's just the further you get removed from making that choice, the harder it is. And just a couple of notes on, I think other things have been said here about low-income workers. I do think when given the proper tools, even those on the lower end of the pay scale can and will be able to develop a nest egg, especially if they start early in life. So it's the difference between abject poverty and being a little more self-sufficient, being able to afford food and maybe a gift for your grandchildren. For many seniors who don't make a lot, that's a big deal. So do think that I do believe that we need to work on good paying jobs and making sure people can make money, but I don't believe that we should avoid trying to help low income folks at least get a strategy to build assets. And I think that's important. One other thing that I did want to include in here is that I think there's a number of roles for the public and private sector here. The Treasury, I think, has the opportunity to help pool some folks that probably aren't served well in the market. Yeah, I think of like, I don't know anyone that's going and selling retirement plans door to door in my neighborhood. I live in outer southeast Portland. That's not a very efficient way to make money. If you're in that business, you probably want to go after larger groups of assets. And I think we've seen the same is true of small employers. It's difficult for them to get into this market. So can the Treasury pool those to make them a more attractive grouping? I think that's important. Now, who manages that money, I think, should just, in our version of this, in my mind, should just be a transparent and competitive choice. But I do think there is a role where we can help bundle this market in a way that just isn't being served. And I think that would be greatly helpful for those Oregonians who are currently left out because, like we said, the workplace is important to them. So I think you guys have a tough job. I think that's a lot of information that you'll need to take in. And most of all, one thing that is just going to continue to be difficult is whatever you do decide may not pay off for 30 years, right? Because the workers who will get the greatest benefit are going to have to be put on the right path to retire someday, and we may not see the fruit of our labor here. So thank you for the time. And we also would, along with AARP, offer any resources we have to help make your job easier.
Great. Thanks, Matt. Dr. Rodriguez, Joyce, good seeing you. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair, Task Force members. My name is Lily Hogue. I'm the Policy Director at Family Forward Oregon. We advocate on economic issues that affect women and families across the state. I wanted to thank you for taking up this incredible opportunity to discuss retirement security for all Oregonians, and particularly to thank Representative Leininger for mentioning women and the importance of women living in poverty in old age. What we know is that motherhood is the leading predictor of poverty in old age. Primarily because women take time out for caregiving responsibilities, because we know they are paid less in their jobs, and they are more likely to be in part-time, low-wage, or flexible work. What we also know is that times have changed, and women now make up half the workforce, and that three-quarters of families have a woman or a mother as a breadwinner or co-breadwinner. So those women are working, but they're retiring into poverty. We see that as a major problem in our state, certainly, and that this has knock-on effects for families now and today. What that means is that we often have not just that those women are retiring into poverty, but that likely their children and likely their daughters might have children of their own who they're caring for while they're caring for their mother, their aunt, who's living in poverty, and that creates a great financial strain on families. I'd like to talk a little bit about why we love some of the recommendations that Matt just made. Something that's easily available through the workplace and that can be carried from job to job without financial penalty is incredibly important to women and mothers in particular, who, as I said, are more likely to leave jobs for caregiving responsibilities and likely to enter into a new job or take many different types of jobs. We also see that it's incredibly valuable that they can contribute to this even when they're not working. Women have less Social Security income than men because, as you know, that they are not having money put into that while they are out of the workforce. And in fact, women have, on average, less than 70% of a man's savings in retirement. So we can think about that. We also really, there's something that has not been brought up yet, which I'd like to mention, which is that, you know, not only do we need a cost-effective and easy-to-use option for people who are financially poor, but also for people who are time poor. So often mothers and families struggle just making it work day to day, and they don't have the time to invest in searching out the right plan, the best plan, and likely they have less returns on those savings because of that. And we know that they're probably less likely to make the best decision or the most financially advantageous decision for their retirement. And you know, I think just throughout this process, focusing on how a lack of income, or for low-income families and particularly women, how that can affect how you save for retirement, and also how we can make a program that specifically not just looks at how these groups of people are affected, but actually chooses that as its focus. And says that we're actually going to lift up this particular group of people and make that a main focus of this discussion and of the system, because when we move mothers and families out of poverty, and when certainly that leads to women not being in poverty in retirement, I think our whole state will be better off. So thank you.
Great. Thank you, Liz.
Thanks so much. For the record, my name is Stephen Michael. I'm the State Director for the Main Street Alliance of Oregon. First off, thank you all very, very much for volunteering your time to be a part of this task force. We see this as you guys being really on the forefront of this, of finding a solution to this crisis. I'm 27 years old, and if I weren't doing this work, I wouldn't be thinking about retirement, and I think that's honestly one of the big problems. I think if we get people starting to think about this a lot sooner, then maybe putting $20 or $30 away each month, and if we've got an easy, accessible way to do that, there'd be an opportunity to have a nest egg and be able to retire and not rely on Social Security and Medicare in old age. So that's just a personal note on that side. On the Main Street Alliance of Oregon side, we've submitted, for your reference, our Businesses Baby Booming Report we released last year. And while this primarily focuses on the need to protect Social Security and Medicare, a lot of the data that we've come out that's in that report, too, I feel like is valuable in regards to small business owners in this conversation. We found that across the country, more than a third of small business owners, and that's businesses with 100 or fewer employees, are at or near Social Security's full benefit age, retirement age of 66. That's a lot of small business owners who are going to be retiring very soon. In Oregon, that's almost 40% of small business owners in the state are at or near retirement age. Now, I mean, Treasurer Wheeler talked about this being a small business state, and I think that really goes to show that this is a crisis that's looming here. We need to figure out a solution before we get too far into it. Now, small business owners, like their employees, are facing challenges for saving for retirement. Not only are small business owners significantly less likely to hold retirement assets than a lot of their workers, they also found that owners of the smallest businesses are the least likely to have those kinds of resources. And we found anecdotally, too, from talking to business owners all across the state, that the vast majority of folks we talk to, when we ask if they've got retirement savings, they say, well, this is it. This is my business. This is my retirement. And that's a pretty big problem in itself as well. We've seen that actually 88% of the folks that we've talked to over the course of the last year don't offer a retirement plan to their employees. Now, that's mostly, again, anecdotally, from the fact that it's confusing and it's really complicated for them, and a lot lot of these small business owners are not only the shopkeeper, but they're also the HR, they're also payroll division, they're also, you know, recruiting and hiring and making sure that, you know, they've got customers coming into the door as well. So this is a lot of things that business owners, small business owners in Oregon are already doing. And so if we can find a way to make this a really simple way that they can offer this benefit to their employees that everybody from our entire state can benefit from, then we would definitely be in support of moving forward in something like that. Additionally, we've also been talking to folks about this task force and about the ideas and policies and principles that you guys are going to be talking about over the course of the next few months. And we have found that almost 70% of business owners across the state, in conservative parts of the state and liberal parts of the state, in rural and metro, almost 70% of business owners we talk to are in support of a pooled retirement option, where the businesses themselves, the business owners themselves, aren't the ones who are entirely reliable or aren't the ones who are in reliable for providing that kind of benefit to their employees. And so we will say that, you know, not only are issues like this really important and definitely something we need to figure out, but we know that, you know, with more and more people retiring, if we've got people who are retiring that are financially stable, then that's also more people, that's another whole sector of buying power for our small businesses. If people have more money that they've put aside that they feel financially stable, then they're going to be able to spend more in local businesses, and that's money that's being able to help recreate our middle class and get our economy back on track. So thank you very much for the work that you're doing. And we at the Main Street Alliance of Oregon are happy to be a resource as well moving forward, and we're definitely going to be tracking the work you guys are doing as well.
Thanks, Steve.
Chair Wheeler and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the public policy advocate for the American Association of University Women of Oregon, and I'll keep it sort of brief. I, too, echo some of Lily's reminders about the reason why women are more apt to be in trouble in retirement, and that's Pay Equity Day is April 8th. That's the day that women finally reach the same level of monetary compensation as a man did the year prior. We have some research, a research and position paper on retirement for women that I've sent to Ms. Nordland, and so she can share it with you. It is very rich with other report data that you can then access some of those reports. It's a little bit dated. I think it's 2012, but it will at least point you to some really good locations for that. Again, I can echo some of Main Street Alliance, having been a small business owner myself. You forgot to say that you take care of the restrooms, too. make it simple and make it easy for employers to offer to their employees, and even as simple as potentially doing the deposits for the employees via the combined payroll reporting form that you send to the employment division. Don't create another level of bureaucracy that the small business owners have to do, because they, you know, you could combine it with the payroll that you send to the employment on whatever schedule your small business or your large business reports on. But again, there's a wealth of information on our position paper on women in retirement, and it will lead you to a lot of other places, and we again stand ready to help you in the efforts to create a better world for all Oregonians, women included.
Thank you, Marcia. Thanks, Steve. Lily. Appreciate it. How many more people do we have who would like to testify?
One, two, three. Perfect.
No. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Wheeler and members of the committee. My name is Jan Meekums. I'm the State Director for NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business. This year, we're celebrating our 71st anniversary. We have about 7,500 members in Oregon who are small business, Main Street businesses representing every trade and type of business imaginable across the entire state. We also have about 350,000 members nationwide. And this is a very important issue, and it is one that affects all levels of our society, and it affects the entire country and Oregonians. Represent is truly a small business issue because big businesses do have a tendency to have employer-sponsored and employee retirement programs, where the small employer not only does not have a retirement plan for themselves, but many of them do not have one for their employees. And it's a matter of economics. It's often because they simply cannot afford it. And the concerns, we are glad that this task force exists. We were very involved with the legislation. And the fact that it's being researched and studied is important. Some of our concerns is that the college is being compared to the college plan, which has been very successful in Oregon, and Oregon should be very proud of that. But it was not mandated. It was not run through businesses. And it was educated. It was education that brought people to the plan and to its success. We've always been an advocate of education. In school, we educate for nutritional health, physical health. We need to start educating early on for financial health. And we also need to educate our employees about financial health. And so I think education is a very important piece of this problem. And the other thing that's been mentioned is a robust economy is probably one of the best things that we can create, is an environment for businesses to flourish and thrive. It's also been mentioned about the mills in our state, and we know the devastating effect that the closing of mills have had in those communities, and the effect that it's had on retirement, on the effect it's had on health services in those communities, and the heavy demand. So if we can, I know that's beyond this task force, it's beyond the subject matter here, but I think we as policymakers and those who contribute to policy need to do everything we can to create a more robust economy for small businesses in this state. And everything else has pretty much been addressed, but I just want to tell you that we're concerned about the mandate aspect, that would be a great concern to us. We did poll our members on a mandated state retirement fund. 93% of our members were opposed to it. Some of those may even offer retirement plans, but it's the mandating part that is difficult because it's a one-size-fits-all, and most businesses, if they can, they provide the best they can for their employees because their employees are important to them, and for many, they're like family. So if they can provide, they will and do. So I think education is a very key part of this, and we're very concerned about ERISA if we had something that was mandated that was run through the businesses. And that's our concerns. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer. I'm here representing NAFA Oregon, and NAFA stands for the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors. So you have in front of you a paper that I provided. NAFA Board, at its meeting this past winter, has supported a resolution that would encourage this task force to work on the educational components of this issue. We recognize the issue of financial security and savings, but not just for retirement, it's for all financial savings. Many times, younger Oregonians specifically, and you know, anyone in the U.S., but younger people, maybe the best use of their dollars when they're first starting out is not a retirement plan, because then if they have a need for something in the future, such as buying a house or emergency issues for finances, they need to have savings that's not tied up in retirement first before they get started into a retirement plan. So our members would like this task force to focus on the educational side of it, determining what the impediments are, and working through the private sector model which currently exists to solve those impediments. In that arena, the board has voted to support a private partnership or private-public partnership with the stakeholders, the legislature, you as a task force, the treasurer's office, whoever would want to from the government side, to work together in this public-private partnership, include NAFA, include the insurance companies, and include NFIB, the other groups that have testified in front of us that are private groups, to work together to solve this educational part of it, because we believe it is an educational issue. Our members are on every street and every block, just about in every town in Oregon, who are providing these products that you're talking about that are needed for savings, whether it's retirement or other savings. And our members would be happy to work with the Main Street Alliance or any other group that wants to come forward to talk about savings and the best ways to do it, and how to do it with portable accounts. That's what our members offer. So I encourage you to look at the educational side, focus on that. It wasn't just by happenstance that that got put into the bill. I'd like to point out specifically sub H in section 2 of the bill, which says specific educational and marketing strategies that the state of Oregon and private entities can pursue and encourage businesses and residents of the state to increase awareness of and participation in retirement savings plans. It's part of your charge that you shall do, not one of the optional ones, one of the things you shall look at. Other things you've talked about already, appreciate all that. I'd like to also point out to sub 3 of section 2, and while many of you talked about and focused on the first half of that sentence, which deals with the ERISA issue, there is an or, and then the sentence goes on, and it says that would result in tax treatment that is less favorable than that provided under existing provisions of the IRS code. So this is a two-part sentence. It isn't just ERISA. You also shall not recommend plans or products that are less favorable than what's currently being offered by the IRS code. That's a key issue. That don't ignore the second half of that sentence or that subsection. So with that, our members are happy to be involved, would love to be involved, look forward to your participation, your recommendations. We will be here at the task force meetings, wherever they happen, to be providing guidance or course correction if we think you need it as you move forward. So we look forward to that. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, and thank you.
Thank you, Roger. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the task force. My name is John Mangan, and I'm the Regional Vice President for the American Council of Life Insurers. Our motto is retirement security for life, and it seems like I've been doing this most of my life. I started at Standard over 30 years ago. But I just want to point out, we want to be a resource to you because, first and foremost, we applaud you taking a leadership role in looking at this issue. For us, it's the core issue of what we do, and it's what we're trying to achieve across the country. And we personally believe that leadership is necessary in this arena because of the impact of this issue. From the President's recent announcement of a MyRA program through Congress and all the things they're looking at to try to address this issue all the way through to the states and to private business owners, all of those leaders are going to have to take a role in improving the situation that we have. But as a person who's had this experience, I just want to offer us as a resource. We're actively involved in state legislation around the country. We're actively monitoring the California study, which is really just getting started. That's going to have their second meeting next week. They're about to hire consultants. I totally agree with the previous recommendation that you would benefit from talking to staff at the Treasury there that's staffing the board and their study. They're doing a diligent and, I think, very thorough job of looking at all the questions that you probably want to look at as well. And you've raised some issues about what kind of data do we want to find? And we have access to quite a bit of data. We have data about the actual motivational things that stop people from saving, even when they have access to a plan. We can present that research to you. It's very interesting. We also have lots of data on what structures work well. Some of them work very well, and others don't work well, and some work well for large companies, but they don't work well for small companies. We can definitely give you research on that.
That's great.
And we can talk about some of the things, the strategies that work specifically. You talked about auto-enrollment, auto-escalation. We're looking at the national level at reducing some of the legal and structural impediments, even with ERISA, which we think is an important worker protection law. for all private plans. We are trying to work on some things that simplify that structure for small businesses. Because if you can simplify that and come up with something we call a starter 401k, where a small business could have that type of plan that a larger business has, but without some of the anti-discrimination and other issues that stop small business from having it, we think you could make a lot of progress. So we want to be a resource to you. We're happy to provide that information at your request or just as needed during your deliberations.
Great.
Thank you.
I appreciate it, John. And I think Dick had a question. And ordinarily, when you give public testimony, this isn't our opportunity to grill people. We want people to feel comfortable in coming up. But questions, clarifications, I think are appropriate if that's all right.
Yeah, several of the speakers, including some of you, made reference and emphasized the need for education. Before that term becomes too ambiguous, how would you define education in the context in which you're using it? And any one of you, right?
To me? Jan Meekins with NFIB. As I mentioned, there's all levels from elementary school, but more specifically, we're probably looking at the adult population. I know that when I went to school, we weren't even taught how to balance a checkbook or manage a checkbook. That's pretty basic. And so someone where you don't even teach them that basics to have a viewpoint on how to plan for their future, and if you put this much away today, what at such and such, just investment, retirement, education. And then in the workplace, maybe something that's part of when someone is onboarded to their job. They're sat down and they're given a brochure that tells them what's available to them in the state for the purpose of savings and plannings. And most of our small businesses that was mentioned, they don't have an HR. They don't have a legal department. They don't have a payroll department. It is the small business owner that wears all of these hats. So if there is maybe something that's prepared that they could utilize to educate their employees in these small businesses on what is available, and a website that they could go to that they could plug in their income or they can plug in their finances, and it can tell them how much they can save and what they need to save. Something is one thought, but I'm sure that there's elaboration beyond that.
Yeah, thank you for the question. And I guess from our perspective, from the perspective of NAFA and what our letter to you and what the board vote kind of would like you to consider and think about is that's what you need to do. That's what the focus of this task force should be, is what would be the best and most efficient and most needed education to solve the problem of not just retirement savings, but all financial security for Oregonians. And we would like to see the FAT task force focus on that aspect of it rather than recommending certain plans or certain types of plans. Find out what the impediments are to savings, figure out the best way to solve those impediments, and the best way to educate Oregonians on those methods. That's what we would like the partnership with you to do, because we don't have all the answers. Our members, as I said, are in every street corner, in every legislative district in the state. We have members doing this work now, and we need, you know, the more we can educate consumers on what the benefits of savings are, the more it will benefit Oregon and Oregonians. So that's what we'd like you to focus on.
Great.
Thank you.
Any other follow-ups?
John, thank you. Roger,
thank you.
Jan.
Thank you.
And John, I would be interested in that information if you wouldn't mind shooting that along.
Absolutely.
I would.
I'll
that would be helpful
to
me. Thanks so much. Appreciate it. Anybody else? Anything else for the good of the order, ladies or gentlemen? All right. With that, we are adjourned. We'll reconvene on a date to be determined.